The following message was recorded live at Crossroads Church, a grace-centered community in Central Alberta.
So this summer, we've been looking at the Ten Commandments as God's how-to guide on living life. But you know what? There's lots of other how-to guides on living life out there. And most of them promise us results. Let me give you an example. So this spring, I decided I was going to garden. But I'm a newbie and I don't really know much. And the problem is, my yard doesn't have a fence, which means deer. So I spent a bunch of time Googling on the internet how to keep deer out of my garden, how to build a sturdy deer fence that was easy and cheap, because I'm cheap. And I also spent, you know, how to make deer spray homemade. So I followed these experts, and these internet people, they know everything. They've got all the ideas. I don't know much about gardening, but they seem to have it all the answers. So I followed them and I did what they said. And I've been waiting for the last few months to, you know, reap the benefits of following their ways. But I learned a valuable lesson. Don't follow any how-tos unless you've seen their credentials, their end result. Because all I've ended up with for all my work is I could make a how-to guide on how to keep deer well-fed and happy. It's been pretty disappointing. The Ten Commandments aren't a guide like that, because in it, God gives us His credentials. Right before the list, we hear God say this, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." He tells us what He's all about, and He says, "Look at my track record. I've done it. Here's my how-to." And it's not a how-to obey God and how to keep Him very happy. It's a how-to guide on how to not be enslaved. It's a guide on freedom. The second commandment speaks to us because it says to us, don't follow all the other how-tos out there. They're only going to lead you into slavery. They're not going to work. And if you want a visual picture to help you know what that looks like, just take a look at my garden. Those were my raspberry plants, the little sticks. It was a little bit disappointing, to say the least. To start today, I want to read you some lyrics from an old Bob Dylan song. It goes like this. You may be a construction worker working on a home. You may be living in a mansion. You might live in a dome. You might own guns. You might even own tanks. You might be somebody's landlord. You might even own banks. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, you're going to have to serve somebody. I just wasn't anticipating it was the deer I was going to be serving this summer. But the lyrics of this song really get at the heart of what the second commandment is all about. Whether you're rich, poor, powerful, we were made to be worshipers. It's what we are. It's who we are. Dogs bark, cats meow, deer eat gardens, people worship. But it's the direction of our worship, where our worship is targeting to. That's what the second commandment calls into question. We're going to serve somebody, but who's it going to be? If you'll turn with me to Exodus 20, verse 3 to 6, or if you want to follow along on the screen, we'll read the commandment here together. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. At the very outset of this commandment, we're to recognize two things about ourselves. The first, as I said, is we're worshipers. But what does that really mean? For most of us, this isn't a term that we use every day. Probably we only hear it on Sundays when we're, you know, sitting at home or here gathered together and somebody up here says, "Would you stand with me and worship?" Sing it. And that's not a wrong use of the term. It's just only one meaning. To worship means this: giving all your mind's attention, all your heart's affection to something or someone. As the command says, it gives us a picture of bowing down. We're gonna serve something. The second thing we learn about ourselves is we are image makers. Image makers. We are creative beings. And I was thinking this week about all the creativity that has gone into making this service possible. Whether you're watching online or whether you're here, God has given us incredible abilities to be able to craft images and put them into reality. And in this context, it's amazing because all of that is aimed at glorifying God. But how often is it that human creativity doesn't point towards God? When creative images become the focus of our attention instead of the creator. There's an old theologian from long ago named John Calvin, and he said this. He said, people are idol-making factories. That's what we are. Today, I want to start by walking us through a bit of the ancient custom of idol making, because this commandment is a little bit further removed from our context than most of the other commandments. We know what it is to steal. We know what it is to lie. But there's probably no kids in here who have recently been given timeouts for idol making. We don't do this. It's not our culture. So I want us to look at three questions about idols: the what, the why, and the how. First, what is an idol? Depending on the translation you use, you might see the word image or idol or even something like graven image. What it means is a carved wooden object. In other words, don't carve yourself a wooden object and worship it. And we think, no problem. Most of us aren't much for carving. I've never carved anything. I don't even carve turkeys. Maybe some of you are in the same boat. This doesn't really relate in our mindset. And what we need to understand here, though, is even in the Old Testament, that term, idol worship, came to change as people's worship changed over time. Starts out wooden carving. Elsewhere, it becomes images of metal or stone or pictures, paintings. And by the time we get to Ezekiel, it says this: these men have set up idols in their hearts. An idol isn't one thing. It's anything that consumes your mind or heart more than God. But that brings us to the second question, because if it can just be a picture in our mind or our heart, why did people way back when go to all the work of getting themselves little idols? It's a good question we should be asking. And to answer it, I want us to put ourselves in the shoes of an ancient Egyptian farmer. And if you're an Albertan farmer, that's not too hard for you, because just like back then and now, farmers need the rain and farmers need the sun. Technology hasn't changed those factors. Ra was the god of the sun, the Egyptians believed. But the problem with the sun is it's way off there. The sun is over the whole world. How do I go about getting the sun to pay attention to my little plot of land when I need it most? So they would go to the local craftsperson and buy an image. And it didn't matter what it looked like. Archaeology has shown us that actually most of their idols looked like something a kid could carve, and most of them looked the same. It really wasn't important how it looked. What mattered is what it was going to represent. So they would take this lifeless thing and bring it home and have a commemoration service where they would speak words over it like this: if you, Ra, will come and dwell here with me, I will serve you. And then they would serve it. Things like they would bring it grapes and wine and meat and the best that they had. They would dress it up in fancy clothes, and they would even play music for this idol. And us in 2020 think, oh brother, like how do these people not realize it's not eating the grapes, right? Like we see that it's not, like what was wrong with them? But we gotta think about it in these terms. Just like you or I wouldn't fit on a picture of somebody we care about because it represents them. So too, they believed this represented a power that they really, really needed. And they weren't so concerned that the God was hungry with their food as their gifts represented their time, their money, their mind's attention, heart's affection, their giving, their gifts as worship. People kept and made idols to try and control the idol's power, to bring it close. The farmer wants to control the sun, but as he gives it his worship, the sun ends up controlling the farmer. And then what happens come harvest time? When he's been feeding the grapes and doing all his stuff, but now there's a storm coming and it looks like hail. And he thinks to himself, oh no, the gods must want more. And we know from archaeology, from history, and from the Bible itself that sometimes ancient people paid very high prices in their worship, even sacrificing their own kids. We think, how could they do this? But serving the gods is always costly. Well, third, how do they go about choosing an idol? If you've ever seen lists of idols from ancient Greece or Rome or Egypt, you'll know these people had idols for literally everything. And I don't know how they'd keep them all straight, let alone how do they pick these things? Well, it was based on two things: their loves and their fears. What they loved most or what they feared. And sometimes those two go hand in hand. Let me give you an example from the Old Testament. Jacob and Rachel and Leah. So Rachel and Leah are sisters that are married to the same man. And unfortunately for Rachel, in the ancient world, the only way women could gain status was to have kids. And her sister Leah has lots, but Rachel doesn't. What is it that gets her mind, attention, and heart's affection? What does she love more than anything? She would love to have kids. What does she fear? She fears not being good enough. And there's this, as the story goes on, the family is about to move. And Rachel does something where she steals her father's idols to bring with them. And I always scratch my head at this because I think, well, you know, Jacob becomes Israel. He's the father, he's the Israelite, like the Israelites come from him. These people, this family worships God. What are they doing stealing idols? And what we need to understand is in the ancient world, there was no such thing as fertility treatments. Fertility treatments back then were fertility idols. In other words, for Rachel, all of her neighbors and friends would have expected nothing less of her. Of course, you should do everything in your power to get what you need. She's not intentionally trying to turn her back from God. She's just doing what it takes to get what she loves, to save from her fear. But as the story goes on, she pursues this so much that it ends up costing her family relationships. It costs her son Joseph his family relationships. And in the end, Rachel dies in childbirth. Serving the gods was costly. I hope that gives us a bit of a picture of idol worship back then. And for the remainder of our time, I want to actually just walk us through the commandment and look at three reasons why God condemns idol worship. It says, don't make idols, don't worship them, but why? The first reason is this: idols distort us. They distort us. Psalm 115 is a psalm that's written reflecting on the second commandment. And in it, the psalmist goes on to describe how ridiculous it is when we worship things that people have created. He says, they have mouths, they can't speak. They have ears, they can't hear. And he goes on to describe it. And in verse 8, he says this: Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. He's saying we become like what we worship. We become like what we worship. In other words, idols distort us. They change us. And I want to give you a picture of what I mean by that word distort. If any of you have ever seen Lord of the Rings or you've read the books, you will know the character Gollum, okay? Gollum is a character who starts off just like any of us. But he finds a ring of power. And as he finds it, he keeps it. And at the beginning, he's just keeping it safe. But the longer he has it with him, the more it becomes precious to him. And soon it's the most precious thing to him. And then it begins to distort his character, his appearance. And by the end of it, Gollum doesn't even know his own name. It's changed him. He's lost himself. And as we think for a minute, I want us to just think about our own culture. What are the idols? What are our rings of power that we hold on to that can distort us? It could be anything. Anything. But for starters, where does our money go? It goes to entertainment. I was reading recently, if you follow sports, you will know Patrick Mahomes just signed a 10-year contract for $500 million. That means every time he laces up to play a game, $3 million. And that is crazy. It's good for him, I suppose. But the amount of money that we give to these things, and Hollywood is the same. These people that we look to. And it isn't so much just that we're paying into this with our money. I haven't given Patrick Mahomes my money. COVID's helped us with that, actually. We can't always go to the big things, but we can still pay into it with our time, with our time. In our culture, our daily and weekly TV rituals, they're often stronger than our spiritual rituals that we keep. And it might not be bad watching bad things or doing sports aren't a bad thing, but the time we invest shapes us. Or I was thinking about this pandemic. You know, in this pandemic, there's two idols that popped to my mind that I've never really thought about before. The first one is this, the idol of our own lives. You know, I don't know if you remember at the beginning when everything started getting really crazy and it was like shutting down every day and I had to go to the grocery store and I went there for just normal things, but I noticed there was no flour left. There was only two bags left and I thought, maybe I should get flour, I don't know. And the fear in the people around me, and then I start feeling the fear. And we're living in a culture right now that's wrestling with the drive to do whatever it takes to save us from our fear of death. And it's an idol. Or on the other side, we can idolize freedom. You know, we hear the word regulation and guideline, and we think, you can't tell me what to do. That's some of our default. You can't tell me what to do. If your store says that, I have to do that, I just won't shop at your store. And it isn't so much about the mask itself, the action. I don't care about the action. But in times of pressure, it's worth asking ourselves the question, what is driving me? Is it an idol? Or of course, money. We all know about money. Jesus points this one out in the New Testament when he speaks about idolatry in Matthew 6:24. Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And if it was an idol in Jesus' day, it's certainly an idol for us now. We think of all the time we spend going up and down the aisles looking for things, things we need, or want. Or surfing the internet or checking our stock options. Money so often drives us. But the words of Jesus here in Matthew, they're not so much, he's not just speaking to money, it's kind of a fill in the blank sentence. You cannot serve both God and blank. You cannot serve both God and achievement. You cannot serve both God and care so much what your peers think of you. You cannot serve both God and that relationship. You cannot serve both God and obsess about your physical appearance. You cannot serve both God and be enslaved by lust and pornography, because we become like what we worship. Worshiping God means an undivided heart. Undivided heart. But we've gotten really good at being divided in our culture. We actually love this. We're the multitasking generation. The other day, I was parked at the stoplight, and five cars turned past me, and four out of the five drivers were on their phone while they're turning. We do this all the time. I do it all the time. I'll be at home, and I'm catching up with my parents, and I'm paying my bills. Or I'm cooking supper, and we think, oh, we're getting so much done. This is our way of life. Until somebody calls us out. And a couple months ago, my youngest daughter called me out. She's 2.5, and I was holding her in my arm, and I'm sure I had something very important to do. I was checking some emails on my phone, holding her, and she's talking to me. I'm doing the old, And finally, she'd had enough. And with her one hand, she smacks my phone down. And with her other hand, she grabs me by the face and turns me to look her right in the eye. And she says, "Stop your phone, mommy." And I thought, she could barely speak, but that's what she said to me. And it's as if she's saying, "I deserve your undivided attention, mom." And that's what Jesus is saying to us. It says here in Exodus 20, verse 5, it says he's jealous. It's not a selfish jealousy. It's like a marriage. There's no loving spouse out there who says, you know, yeah, I'll just sit back and watch while my husband or wife destroys themselves. No, he's jealous for us because he knows the stakes if we turn to other things. We become like what we worship. It's like Gollum. Idols distort us. The second reason why we are not to worship other things is because idols distort God's reputation. They distort God's reputation. Exodus 20, verse 4 says, "Don't make an image in the form of anything on the earth beneath or in the waters below." In other words, there is no one image in all of creation that can actually represent God. And here, I'm not so much talking about our cultural idols, the things out there. I'm talking about our Christian idols. The things in here that we love. Maybe it's something we love about God. Maybe it's the good things or our particular hobby horse that we get on about, that we make the thing. For example, the Bible. Now, the Bible is something that Christians believe and say we need to study it and know it so that we can know how to live. It's God's word speaking to us. But if we put the Bible in the center, instead of listening to the voice of Jesus and obeying what he says, we can become people who know a lot about the Bible, but we don't look anything like Jesus. And the people around us, they start to think our God is just a hard-nosed rule follower. He's not a God of freedom. We misrepresent him. Or it might be something like social action. Maybe you're a young person out there and you are passionate about issues today, whether it's something like racial justice or ethical shopping or climate change. And we say, God is a God of justice and he cares about justice. God cares about these issues. But if we put them at the center, we can actually become people who bully and push instead of representing a God of love. Or maybe we just present our issue and the people around us don't ever even hear the name of Jesus from our lips in the way we talk. Even good idols can distort God's reputation. The third reason is this. We're not to worship idols because idols distort those who follow us. In verse 5, it says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children from the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And I might be thinking, what is this hate language? I don't hate God. Most of us wouldn't say, I hate God. It's not the type of hate that we think of. Like, you know, when you feel like you maybe really don't like or hate your little sibling or something like that. It's a different kind of hatred. It's comparison language. It means to put God second. In other words, compared to that thing that gets your time and attention, it is as if you hate God. But it's strong language here. What does it mean? God's going to punish our kids? Is he a vengeful God? You know, I'll show you for not worshiping me. No, it's not like that. What it means here is if I misrepresent God to my kids, how can they see who he truly is? If we misrepresent God to the people around us, it affects their ability to know what he's really like. For example, I know a woman who grew up and her parents taught her to strive to always do her best. They told her, God is watching. So when you mess up, it's not just us you disappoint, you're letting God down, right? And her good was never quite good enough because it was always the question of, what more could you have done? And as this woman has grown up, she's got her own kids now and she struggles so much. She can't rest. She doesn't know how to Sabbath because she's always driven by, I have to do more. It's not quite perfect enough. And even though she teaches her kids that God is a God of grace, what they learn is that God's a taskmaster. And they'll never be good enough for him. And one day, those kids are going to have to choose if that's the image they want to keep following or if they're going to find something else. You know, a phrase I keep hearing in our culture right now is, you do you. You do you, meaning whatever you're going to do, it has no bearing on me or anyone else. You just pick. You live life your way. And the second commandment comes down heavy-handed on this. And it says, actually, the idols you keep, the way I spend my time, the things I go to when no one's watching, whatever it is that I love or fear more than God can actually impact the eternity of those around me. Our kids, those we love. Serving the gods is still costly. And even if they don't know what our idols are, even if they're secret idols, and the kids don't know, I cannot show my kids or those I love who Jesus is if I'm becoming like something else. I cannot serve two masters. But there is good news, because if we keep reading the commandment, we're told that he shows love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. How do we keep this one? How do we keep this one when I know that I am so prone to making idols. I am so quick to turn to things. I can confess it once, and then I find myself back there. We're so quick. We're idol-making factories. And the Bible actually tells us that it's always been this way. Back in Genesis, in the Garden of Eden, it says, God made us to be his image bearers. He made us to represent him into the world. But we worshiped other things. And they twisted us, distorted us. And how then can our world see a true image? And that's why Jesus came. It's why he came. In Colossians 1:15, it says, the Son is the image of the invisible God. He's the exact representation. In other words, if you want a picture of what deep down in your heart will satisfy, you have got to look at Jesus. He came, he died on the cross, he rose again so that we would have the opportunity to have freedom. And the promise here is for anyone, anyone who will cast down their idols, anyone who will say, I have lived my own way, but Jesus, I am turning to you. Anyone who will say, I've done this before, but today I need to cast down my idol. It says, he'll transform us to be more like his image. And the blessing, it says, will last 1,000 generations. I mean, how long is 1,000 generations? This is a serious promise from God. And sometimes we can get hung up on the negative side of thinking, oh, my kids and the third and fourth generation and the idols. But we've got to take seriously that God is offering us a legacy opportunity to impact our kids, to impact Central Alberta for him for years and years and years to come, 1,000 generations, if we will put him first. If we'll put him first. But the question is, am I putting him first? Or has something else crept in the way? We're told there isn't a choice in the matter. We're going to serve somebody. And today, I want us to take a moment and ask ourselves the question, who or what am I serving? Is there anything in my life that has crept its way in to my heart or my home or my worship, the way I speak about God? It's so much easier to notice the idols in the Old Testament. We can see them. They're these shiny little carved things, and we can point out the people and how did the Israelites fall again? How did they do this again? And in our culture, though, when we're the fish swimming in the water, it's harder to see. It's subtle because it's all around us. And sometimes I do the comparison test, and I look at people around me and I say, oh, I'm doing it less than that person. Or, oh, okay, I don't do it near as much as those people. But it's not about comparing, because the things themselves aren't necessarily wrong. It's, does it have my heart? My heart. Does it have my heart? Because I can't serve two masters, so who am I serving? Maybe it's a good thing. Something that you know, God really loves. It can even be Christian ministry, serving the Lord. But if we put it in the center, it can tire us out and become a lifeless thing because we've taken our eyes off of Jesus. I'm gonna ask the worship team if they'll come up. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna sing a song together. And as we sing, I want us to just open our hearts before the Lord and ask that question. Is there anything, even a hint of it? Is there anything in me that's giving God a reason to be jealous, where my attention is divided? And as we sing, let's open our hearts to the Lord and let him speak. I'm gonna pray. Father, thank you that you are patient with us. And thank you that all of the times where we have loved other things and gone after other things, that you say to us, if we come back, if we will cast them down, you will make us more like you. And so Jesus, today as we listen, would you speak to us? In your name, amen.